Hey folks, just a quick content note up front here. The game that we're discussing in today's episode features psychosis as well as other mental health issues. If you feel that you're sensitive to any topics like that, you might want to sit this episode out. But otherwise, I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome, folks, to the Slowpokes podcast. We play great games, just a little bit late. I'm Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number one, John Aglaitis.
This week, episode, time, fortnight, whatever it is you measure the non-Euclidean item we consider to be space-time to be.
I love this intro.
However you measure it, this incident, we are discussing Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice, to round out season three.
Yes.
With a massive, massive, huge, big game culture, lots of that one.
Nailing it. Yes, this is the end of our arbitrary season system, season three. It is over, and we thought we would pick a game that we were both, like, frantically excited to play.
Yeah, I'm not going to surprise many people to say that the last few episodes I've appeared on, I've been a little bit dry over.
And you also didn't appear in one.
Yes, I did not appear in one, so that's a null data point.
Oh.
But the last few, I mean, we had Metro, we had Injustice, we had a couple of others, and it's been a little bit flat as far as David's experience. So I was really, really looking forward to going into a very interesting and unique artifact in gaming for a whole lot of different reasons, but something that was massively critically acclaimed. I don't know if this won best game at the Game Awards.
I know it did win awards. And
I know that it won more than anything else. Yeah. But I think the best game was probably Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, most likely it would be. Have you met video games? Of course, Breath of the Wild won. I think it got a BAFTA, though.
Oh, yeah.
I think it for audio.
Melina Jurgens got a BAFTA. I'm going to presume her surname is pronounced Jurgens.
Yep.
Feel free to correct me. I've never heard somebody say it that I can trust.
She deserves that BAFTA, by the way. Because we're going to talk about this game, and surprise, quite liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty fucking sick.
Oh, it's so good. I think the more recent thing that's made me this excited was H-Bomber Guy's video for Sonic Lore Analysis. Sonic 2.
It's 3?
I can't remember which Sonic. It's very important Sonic.
Okay. It's Sonic 2, but it's the Lore Analysis 3.
Yes, that's correct.
See, I remember things that happened to me. I don't know about you.
When
things are important to me, I make a note of what they are.
I'm so sorry that I focus on the emotional significance of things in my life and not the finicky details.
Like blaze past all of the things that make them what they are and who they are. That's fine.
Okay.
We're not talking about interpersonal relationships. We're talking about videos on the internet. Please continue, John.
Oh, God, I'm getting really existential about my own life. The point is, as long with that video, this is a game I played, and I was not expecting to be as excited. I was expecting to have a game.
Sorry, I've just got to interrupt you. Did you bring up that video just to say it was another good thing?
Yes.
Cool. I just wanted to make sure we're on the same page. I thought there was going to be some kind of relation there.
Oh, the relation was actually, I ruined my own anecdote that I mentioned before. This game and that video are both things that I have found so exciting and have made me overfill with ideas and discussion and just get really
engaged.
Okay,
there we go. There's the link. I was just like, man, I really like this. It's like ice cream in that regard. Something that I really like.
Yeah, no, I did just...
like it's a very two-dimensional simile.
Listen, okay, it's been a while between recordings.
It has been a little while. We've had some upsets.
I've forgotten how to human podcast, which is not like mind podcasting. But the point is, I'm more excited about this game after playing it than before.
Yeah. Bam. And I know what you mean. I think a similar example of that idea was Guardians of the Galaxy. When I first saw that, it's the kind of thing that you find creatively inspiring. It's like, wow, this is not only good, it is aspirationally good. Mad Max Fury Road is another movie that's like that. The Beginner's Guide is a good game like that, or Undertale. Something that isn't just fun or exciting or emotionally relevant, but something you go, damn, I would have loved to have been a part of this project, or I would like to make something that is as impactful or as meaningful as this is, maybe if not necessarily in the same way.
There's something that speaks to you and your own personal desire to create that I feel resonated a lot in this game. It felt stylistically and tonally like something I would want to make. It felt very similar and reminiscent. And it was just a gorgeous experience because I was kind of expecting... A lot of people talked about this new... Was it double A?
Yeah, so they described themselves as an independent triple A game. And then there were some people who coined the term double A game. I think all of those suck because they... they're relationally defined to what a AAA game is.
Exactly.
And most of us at this point in time think that AAA is actually a pejorative term, not a positive one.
Yeah, that's a good point.
In a way, a word like blockbuster is not. But yeah, I know what you mean. There's a lot of talk about it being this massive new tier of game.
But I kind of thought it would exist in like a B-grade kind of thing where it was going to be a bit shit, but because it's trying and it has heart, we'll just... sand off those edges to our
Yeah, I wasn't expecting necessarily the greatest game ever made.
Yeah. Yeah, so I expected it to be a bit rough around the edges, but I also expected it to, in some way, have or be influenced by Psychosis, like the character's story.
I mean, that's obviously a huge part of the conversation leading up to this game.
Yeah.
I feel like what I knew about it going in was pretty much what you knew about it, that it was this new kind of project level, this new kind of quality or production style for the game. And that might be interesting from like a
industry
perspective. Yeah. But mainly the idea of it being a game that explores psychosis or at the very least features the psychosis of its main character quite prominently. The game obviously was massively well received by critics and, you know, by players as well. But I mean, of the two, I know which one I fucking care about more, depending on the critic, I guess. But, you know what I'm getting at? That, like, people bought a lot of movie tickets to fucking Transformers. That doesn't mean shit to me.
It's never going
to
let you know.
You know, Battlefield and COD sell super well. They don't get critically acclaimed. And that so the critical part of it is the part that interested me the most.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think it's interesting, though, you said the lead up to this game, because I don't remember there being one. I remember not game and then Hellblade came out.
Yeah, the hype cycle for this one was very, very short. Take this with a grain of salt, but from what I understand, they didn't actually have a marketing budget for the game. It was all generated by word of mouth. Mm. And so when we talk about the advertising cycle, we're talking about like the month or two before release. At the very least, that's where I was aware of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Most of the conversation, though, happened after its release, obviously, and we're a little bit beyond that. This game actually came out in August of 2017, so one of the younger ones that we've done, but long enough, I feel, for the conversation to have happened in a very full way before we come into it.
Definitely. Looking up on it, I could only really find articles close to or when it came
out. Yeah. So every now and then, I play a game that I feel is meaty enough to warrant some actual academic analysis. So I tried to look up some scholarly articles on this, and my fucking God, like, the quality of scholarly articles on video games is still garbage. Like, I read this one article, the thesis statement of it was basically, this paper argues that video games can be good. And it was like 1,000 words, and it was just about how emotions and interactivity are more emotions. And a third of the fucking paper was just a brief history of video games. They started off with Space War in the 60s, and the first game to talk about mental illness was Depression Quest in 2013, which, in fairness, is probably true in a meaningful way, but it was just, it was so trite and so exhausting. And the truth is, games journalists often do better than that. It's just...
And I think it's interesting that you bring that up in regards to this game, not only because we've had a 3-hour-long conversation before we've sat down to record.
Yeah, figuring out how we were going to tackle this one was a job unto itself.
Actually, having played this game, I was overwhelmed by how well put together it was.
Yeah, it's very polished.
Yeah.
It's very, very good. And like, it is hard to think of substantive criticisms against this game.
Mm.
And we definitely have them, and we will talk about that in more detail because it's a serious topic that warrants consideration of a lot of different perspectives.
Definitely true.
But at least from my point of view, I find it very hard to say they did this wrong or they did this poorly.
Yeah, I think you're always into a good text to use a wanky term.
Or like an accurate term. Like, yeah, we don't have to shit all over the thing that I studied. That's fine.
It's fine. Sorry, David. I don't know who I'm trying to be cool to, because all the people I'm trying to be cool to use the word text.
Yeah, you use the word text and then denigrate it. Like, you're trying to make yourself cool to zero people. Yeah. There are people think you're a wanker, or they thought it was fine, and now they think you're a wanker.
Listen, David, my personal denigration is very complex, okay? And it's for me to punish myself. But the text, I really feel it warrants discussion and dissection and analysis on how it not only presents the themes and the story, but how it uses the game space and how it kind of brings on board psychosis to not only tell an interesting story about someone who has psychosis, but also not be shitty about it and also use it in part of the narrative. Well,
yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, and I feel like we should probably just try and jump in because we won't have enough time.
Yes.
What I will say very quickly, though, is because of how much there is to say, we normally like to have a spoiler-free section. I don't think we can afford to in this episode. Yeah. So if you haven't played this game, both of us give it a very hearty recommendation, even with some of the criticisms we might bring to the discussion later on.
Yep.
But yeah, it's amazing. It's not going to take up a lot of your time. So I'd recommend giving it a go if you want to play it spoiler-free. Otherwise, feel free to continue with us here now.
Definitely. I would just say that it does have action elements to it, and sometimes it can get a bit spooky. So just FYI.
Yeah, and the game has some pretty specific disclaimers about how it depicts mental health and certain kinds of violence and that kind of thing too. So know what you're getting into before you buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I give it a good old big 10 David thumbs up.
10 David. Oh my God, David, why do you have so many thumbs? That's a lot of thumbs.
I do them in quick succession.
Oh, good. I thought for a second there, it looked like all your fingers were thumbs.
I have never revealed this, but what I am, in fact, Eobard Vong, the Flash's arch nemesis. So I can just move that quickly with my thumbs. And that's how I give it the 10 thumbs up. It's faster than the human eye can perceive.
Failed it.
Yeah, there we go. One of those jokes will stay in. All right, so let's just start really basic and talk about this, how a gamer gator would. I think we just want to get this out of the way and talk about the gamey game stuff.
The game stuff. This is the game stuff.
You already mentioned it's an action game, John. How do you feel it performs on that front?
So I haven't actually played any of Ninja Theory's previous games, but you can really tell that they have experience in making action games when you play Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice.
That's definitely true. I think that what they have is style, and that's what comes through. Because if you play Devil May Cry and a lot of their other action games, they're much more, you know, air juggle, build range, combos, that kind of thing. This game is not that.
No.
But it still has a very competent and specific style to it, which I think is amazing.
And the system that underlies the combat is very robust. Right?
See, because you say robust. Robust is an interesting word. It definitely functions, but it's lightweight. Like, there's not actually a lot of depth to it when you really sit down and analyze it from a gameplay perspective.
Yeah, that's true. But I feel like it's clear and it worked. The combat works.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, there's not too much to it. Yeah. But the thing is, the game is only like 8 or 9 hours long.
Mm.
And so it's not long enough for you to really feel like you're running out of stuff to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Huge chunks of the game, you're not fighting at all, which I think is a huge departure from what Ninja Theory often does.
Mm.
But the combat system they have in there is easy to pick up, and it carries you through the action parts of the game.
Yeah, and it has combos that you can pull together and the blocking and the dodging, and it's just enough to keep you there.
Yeah, and it's carried by that style like I was talking about before. The animations chain together really well. Like, the camera work that they do in some of the moves is really satisfying.
Oh, the camera work they do in general is really satisfying.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do was Senua moves very slowly in combat, but you can sprint towards enemy to kind of charge them, and the camera drops down low, and then you'll come in with either like a melee lunge or a big overhead swing. Yeah, and all of that is just so satisfying to do.
Yeah.
It feels very good to fight as Senua, and she feels like an incredibly capable warrior, which I think is important in the way that they depict her self-reliance in the game as a whole.
And as we talk about the acting in general, characters are really well mo-capped, and the way they've flowed the animation together is just seamless. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. Most of the combat is with basic enemies that come in different combinations. So you've got, you know, oh, you've got your berserker and two little guys, or you've got three little guys. It's all pretty basic stuff, and that works really well. And honestly, is probably the most satisfying kind of combat. But then occasionally you get your boss fights, and those are pretty fucking good for the most part.
And genuinely surprising. Usually when you have boss fight kind of experience, you'll get one or two that you don't really enjoy. But I just, because of like how short it was and the little changes they made to each of the bosses and how they fight, it was just enough to keep me entertained.
Yeah, they were informed about what they were there to be, sort of narratively, thematically, and metaphorically. And I think there's actually only three bosses in the game, if you don't count the end boss for whatever reason. And each of them were distinct, and none of it was tired or frustrating, and that's very hard to do.
I think the way I phrase up the game section of the games podcast, the game part, is it's really beautiful to look at, it flows really well, and it's fun to move through the world in that kind of engaging, satisfying way when things just feel organic.
And to have a game that has this much style and is presented so well and so well polished, bar those one or two really famous bugs that were fixed relatively quickly. And then you think about the fact that this was made on a small budget with a team of like 20 people. Very impressive. Could every game in the industry be made like this? Fuck no. No way. But it is a testament that a game to this level of quality was made at all, especially considering the amount of work they did on not just the core gameplay stuff, the other technology that they've got and the work they did towards the narrative and the depiction of psychosis. Success or fail, it's a lot of time and resources that they were dedicating to that, as opposed to just the core gameplay, and the core gameplay is still this good.
Yeah, and we'll get into more details about the parts where the game isn't combat, where you're exploring the environments. But just walking around Hell, the North...
Helheim, I think you start in Hell, right? Most of the game you're in Hell.
Yeah, basically. But the environmental palette they use is diverse while themed that Northern Celtic kind of thing. And so, you know, when I think about Hell, I think about a game like Dante's Inferno, which is like the fire, the brimstone.
And really kind of gritty and over the top.
I love the direction they took with the art design and everything.
And I mean, some of it is a little bit predictable. They have a couple of very iconographic images that you've probably seen before. Some things are a little bit tropey, but how that interacts with their depiction of North mythology and Celtic culture and all that kind of thing is sound enough for someone like me. I'm not a history buff. But you're not wrong. Just seeing it is pretty rad on its own.
Yeah. So I think that encompasses all of the 10 out of 10 gameplay things we have. We don't really want to talk about that much longer. And as you can kind of tell, it's not really the main thing that we want to talk about.
Yeah, we just wanted to say that up front so we could just get it the fuck out of the way. Because what's, I think, the most interesting part of this discussion that both of us agree on is how this game approaches the topic of psychosis and mental illness and how we received this game for its depiction of that.
Yeah.
Now, this is not the first game to have discussed mental illness. It's the only one I know of that discusses specifically psychosis, or at the very least in a way that isn't gimmicky. Like, Silent Hill and other horror games have had parts where you're like, what's real and what's not? But that's more of just a genre conceit to get you unsettled. It doesn't talk directly about a specific kind of mental illness.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, do we have a specific definition for psychosis?
Oh, yes. We should probably put that up for people who don't know. Once again, neither of us are experts, but very basically, psychosis is characterized by a detachment from quote-unquote objective reality.
Yeah.
The major symptoms of it are things like hallucinations, so perceiving things that aren't perceivable to other people, images or sounds or voices, and the other element of it is delusions, which are beliefs or conclusions that a person has come to that aren't supported by reasonable objective evidence. So that's things like paranoia can be an element of that, or seeing patterns that other people don't see, lower latent inhibitions and that kind of thing. So making links between things that other people wouldn't necessarily link. Again, very oversimplified discussion of what psychosis is, but if you are unaware of what Center is supposed to be experiencing, it's mainly that, hearing voices, hallucinations, and delusions to some extent, and seeing patterns in the world. So, 101, that's where we're kind of starting the conversation from. I imagine most of you actually played the game, though.
What we want to do is sort of put a frame around how the game depicts things and how we feel about it. Like,
yeah.
I think meta framing was what I was talking about.
Yeah, so it's not an inappropriate term, but basically what we're trying to talk about here is how we as a culture receive this game.
Yeah.
Because whenever a big game comes out, be it a David Cage masterwork or The Last of Us or whatever it is, we as a culture run into these problems where suddenly we're all like, this is our Citizen Kane. This is proof that games are art. We have a tendency, I think, to kind of deify it and throw it up on this pedestal and be like, yeah, this is the movie about racism, or this is the game about mental illness. And I feel like that can really hamstring a conversation about it.
I mean, not only does it force us to tear the work down, because a single work can't be a story for everyone.
Yeah,
This game cannot be a story for everyone's experience of mental health. It is not, and it cannot be. I've read several articles about this game by someone who they have an experience with mental illness, both a personal experience and of caring for someone.
Mm.
And that actually really provided a lot of interesting context. And also there was a quote that D.R. Lacine said in her article, which was about the autistic community. And it's like, if you meet one person with autism, you have met one person with autism.
Yeah.
You can't draw any conclusions about a whole group of people that go through this kind of stuff. And
so I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. That's why I stole it from her article.
Hey, we credited it. So this is academic now.
And we will link to the articles, by the way. And I do encourage people to read them.
What I think is, like, that's very true. And, you know, I have my own experiences with mental illness, specifically depression and some level of anxiety.
Yeah.
I also know people who are on the autism spectrum, who struggle with bipolar and, a collection of other mental illnesses as well. I've not met anybody who experiences hallucinations. But I think that core sentiment is very true of anybody who is part of a often oversimplified group.
Oversimplified and usually demonized.
Yeah, homogenized, right? I think that what's important to think about when we discuss that point, though, is whether or not the perception that this game is the be-all and end-all of psychosis depictions. Is that a problem with the game itself, or is that a problem with how we talk about mental illness, right? And I think that sometimes we can point to the work and be critical of the work. I think Crash is a really good example of a movie that wants to pat itself on the back by not talking fully about a subject, where they kind of depict racism as a problem between individuals, and it's an individual, where they don't actually talk about the mechanisms that support racism. A movie like Rain Man can be criticized for a very specific and stereotyped depiction of what being on the autism spectrum is like. In those two examples, I don't know how much work the creators did to make sure their perspectives were informed. I don't know if it was a genuine effort or if it was cynical. But when you get to something like Rent, for example, that pretends that it's talking about big things but is actually about nothing at all, that's where you can point to the work and go, this is about nothing, and completely blasts past really important topics that it just wants to wear the costuming of.
Yeah.
A game like this, I think it's fair as a person to say this work of art does not fully represent all experiences and I don't feel represented in it. That's completely real, and I never want to dismiss somebody from saying it.
And I think it's important to make that.
While
we're going to discuss what we feel are really strong things the game does, I don't want to say that the people who disagree with us and who have more of a
lived experience.
Or a lived experience are just now wrong.
Oh, they're absolutely not. Yeah. And
conversations are nuanced, everybody.
They are completely 100% right about what they feel in response to this. Like, no one can ever take that from them. And I would be a complete utter fucking asshole if I tried to. But what I want to say here is that these conversations become more complex when more people are having them. Mm-hmm. And as you said just before, it's impossible for any single work to be representative of all people. That's not the work's fault.
Yeah.
Like, the problem is it's the only one. And I think that it's worth bearing in mind that someone had to be first. Yeah. And in 20 years, we might look back on this game and go, wow, that was kind of a limited conversation. I'm glad we've evolved since then. But I honestly feel like not just from the whole, oh yeah, I read the documentary and they can see they put all their effort in and they checked all the boxes, just from playing the game and the way it depicts this character and the care and the nuance in that depiction, I think is very evident. And I feel that it's quite humanizing and understanding of Senua's experiences and what that's supposed to build in us. It is trying to build a sense of empathy, and not in that tokenistic way, and not in a way where she goes through and overcomes and she did it, she won. It's just a deeply, I think, genuine attempt to talk about this.
And I think when you stand alone, there's a desire for you to be more relevant to more people. But not, I don't want to say unfortunately, the story that Hellblade is telling is about, what is it, a 9th century picked warrior, right? And her experience of grief and her process through that while she has psychosis, right? And that's such a narrow focus of psychosis in general. And so really what I'm trying to say is I want more games.
Yeah, that's the solution. Yeah,
that tackle this stuff. And I want more games that talk about it. And I want more breadth of games as well. And I don't want people to shy away from it because one game came up and was not the game for everyone. But that's not how things work.
Mm.
Godfather is not the only movie people need to see. Right? You know, it has problems, it has flaws, all text too. But I think the thing that I will take away is that it draws evidence how lacking games can be.
Yeah.
In that range.
And I will say this, because I mentioned this kind of in passing. I think a bigger problem with this perception that the game is trying to be the be-all and end-all of psychosis is not about the game. It's about how pathetic we are in talking about it, where we go, it's the psychosis game. It's a work of art. It's our Citizen Kane. And like I said, we put this game on a pedestal and we deify it. And we as a culture get so wrapped up in patting ourselves on the back because games can now be art.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very easy to look at a game like this, feel underrepresented or feel even potentially exploited as a person who experiences mental illness, and be resentful of the game and the people who did that work, when really I feel that the bigger problem with that sense of dismissal and oversimplification comes from the people who read the work. And like I said, they want to kind of pat themselves on the back as, yeah, we're gamers and we're cultured now, rather than understanding, like, I mean, one of the first screens the game shows you, I think it's literally the first thing you see when you boot up the game, is a couple of disclaimers about psychosis and about, you know, content notes and that kind of thing, and where you can go to find more info about the kinds of mental illness that are depicted in the game. And I think that that's very indicative of where the mindset was of the creators. That, and again, you know, author is dead, but like the way the work is presented to me.
David, you say the author is dead. There is a video in the game that talks about how they made it.
Yes, fair enough. But what I mean to say is, that me knowing what the author's intent was,
because of the video they showed you in the game,
that they put in the game, shouldn't necessarily influence my reading of the work. But I feel like the way the game is presented is to invite further consideration from neurotypical people.
And just to round out my thoughts, especially because I brought up some articles and then we kind of said a whole bunch of stuff, and I want to be clear, I bring these articles up because they were so well written.
Yeah.
And because most game reviews that I read, it's like we all know what a game review is and they all feel very similar.
Yeah.
You know, you just pick a reviewer who's more of your style, whereas these articles stood out because they had something to say and they were conveying things. And that's what I feel this game does as well. And so this game has inspired interesting and good conversation. And that's really what I'm hoping
and
for.
And I think just as a way of supporting what you just said there, we'll be including the links to the articles critical of the game in the show description here. We're not going to include those, 10 out of 10. Yeah. We did a culture. Gamers finally got it. Fuck you, Roger Ebert.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that this podcast will be us trying to do that. So that's it will be positivity enough. But yeah, you can find those reviews out there for sure.
And the ones that we feel are worth you reading and have that alternate perspective, you'll find those in the show description. Definitely. So feel free to broaden your scope.
Yes.
You want to talk about the actual game now?
Oh, God, we probably should, shouldn't we?
I think we're probably going to leave this one run a little long.
Definitely.
So where to actually start pulling the thread on how this game depicts a mental illness is hard.
Yeah.
I'm going to start talking a little bit personally here. Like I said, I have experienced a particular kind of mental illness. And to help contextualize the game, psychosis is not the only form of mental illness that Senua is dealing with. She is dealing with certain kinds of PTSD, I would say, where she's experienced trauma as a child and also in her adult life. She's dealing with grief at the loss of her partner, and those are examined as part of this game as well.
Yeah, definitely.
The basic story premise of the game is that Senua is trying to infiltrate Helheim and confront Hela, who is basically Norse mythology's version of Satan, because her lover, Dillion, was sacrificed to Hela and is dead, and she wants Hela to release his soul.
So she's gone to the Norse hell to recover her Celtic boyfriend.
Yes, she is a Pict, which we've mentioned before. It's this group of Scottish warriors.
Let's stay away from actual history and facts.
Yeah, Celtic. The word is what I'm looking for is Celtic.
Probably.
But yeah, they're this renowned Celtic community because they were unconquerable by the Romans. They just put up a big old wall and just like, fuck it, they can just have that whole chunk of England. Yeah. Our empire is bigger enough.
Yeah, we don't need to lose any more soldiers, thank you. Just build a wall.
And so they're kind of mythologized as being these legendary warriors, but then of course Anglo-Saxons came in, the Vikings, and committed a couple of atrocities time.
If you'd like to know more, read some history books.
Read some history books, but yeah, colonialism, not just done by the Brits, sometimes done to the Brits.
Yes, a tradition passed down from generation to generation. That's a really sad joke, let's move on.
Yeah, a proud, just sort of generally white tradition.
Oh, yes, it is. Anyway.
So that's the basic backdrop. The fact that a lot of the game is about Senua dealing with trauma that she might have experienced in childhood, or for me, very particularly, the issues of grief surrounding the loss of her partner.
Yeah, definitely.
I actually felt a great deal of emotion.
Empathy?
Yeah, like empathy, like emotional resonance with the game. I felt like a lot of the experiences and the way they were described by the game or depicted in the game resonated with me quite deeply in the ways that I have experienced my own mental health, my own mental health issues, I should say. Of course, one of my mental health issues was not psychosis. So I do understand that I'm speaking from a very limited perspective. And I think there was something very interesting you said about the palatability of this game.
Because we were talking before about it, and we've got like evidence of people who have more lived experience having problems with this game. And I felt like one of the ideas was like, is this game going to be more palatable to neurotypical people and less palatable to people who actually have a lived and personal experience? Because it's trying to be so broad and it's trying to get people on board and present it in a way that they can understand.
Yeah.
Is it going to do a disservice to people who actually experience this?
And that's a big question about art in general, I think. If you're trying to portray what it's like to live an experience to people who cannot experientially relate to it, sometimes you have to figure out ways to quote unquote translate that into a language that they understand. And the better we get about talking about that, the more accurate those depictions are going to be. Because building an understanding doesn't necessarily mean depicting something literally.
Yeah.
What I will say as well, just on that point, we've mentioned this a couple of times, the makers of this game did consult with a number of people, not only mental health experts, psychiatrists and the like, but also people who have lived experience of the conditions that Senua experiences in the game. So while there are definitely people out there who had legitimate concerns and criticisms, there are also people who felt this game was quite good in the way that it was depicted. So it's not to say that those two things like balance each other out or whatever, but I think it's very easy to read the perspective of somebody who is in a marginalized group and feel concerned that they might have been hurt by this game in some way and kind of let that eclipse other people among that same community who actually felt quite recognized by the game. I don't want to make it sound like there was a massive backlash against this game from people who experienced psychosis when there wasn't.
Yeah, I just think that some interesting people who wrote some really good things had some interesting things to say.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But the core point that you make, though, is worth considering.
Yeah.
Do we like this because we don't experience psychosis? And perhaps if we did, I would react to this the same way I reacted to fucking Birdman, which I think is a terrible movie and made me feel really exploited and shat on.
Yeah, or like Fight Club, right? Mm. You know, it's like it spawned a whole generation of people who Fight Club was talking about as being a problem and doing problem things. They saw Fight Club and were like, awesome, Fight Club's
Yeah, this is a little bit different because it's not about the audience being dumb. I mean, I guess in some ways it kind of is. Like, if this game was to do harm, it would lead neurotypical people to have massive misconceptions about how psychosis functions.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest amount of harm this game could do.
Yeah.
And I suppose that is a legitimate concern. So in that way, it is kind of a mirror to Fight Club, which is trying to critique toxic masculinity, and a bunch of people walked away from that going, toxic masculinity is fucking great.
And also, it'd be great if anyone had any other perspectives on that and would send them through to us.
We both confess our ignorance in this area.
Yeah. That being said, let's talk about how the psychosis is kind of brought into the game via those, like, the mechanics.
Yeah, and how that relates to what it is they're trying to give insight into.
And I think the first sort of thing that caught my eye was how Senua has been taught by her companion, Druth, her friend in the wilds, to read Nordic runes.
Mm.
And so to open these sort of magical doors in the world, you have to find these runes in nature. So you scour the landscape, looking at logs and trees and planks and all kinds of things to find a pattern that matches the rune that you're looking for.
Yeah, and then when you find enough of them, the door unlocks. What this is alluding to or exploring is the pattern making we were talking about before, where most neurotypical people might not make the same kind of links as people with different kinds of mental health issues like this would. Sometimes that can go quite deep into paranoia and, like, sprawling what we might even consider as conspiracy theories, where everything is linked and there are these connections that we can't see. And other times it's just simple links between, like, colors and sounds.
And so as the game is kind of teaching you to look into the environment to make these patterns, it kind of interfaces you with seeing things in the world that you wouldn't normally take a second glance at.
Yeah, and I think that that's very insightful, again, to my limited understanding of how hallucinations sometimes work. I mean, we have this idea from a lot of bad movies that hallucinations just kind of spring up fully formed from nothing or whatever. But some of the time, they are influenced by stimuli, and it's an issue of image processing. So, I mean, we've all gotten on that Yanny Laurel train, right?
No, I've refused to listen to it. although someone's new boyfriend made me hear it. Thanks, Sophie.
So the thing that I find very interesting about the whole Yanny Laurel thing is it's an insight into how we like to think that the world is very objective and easily understood, but our brain is kind of just making its best guess at what it's interpreting. And so the exact same sound clip can sound like two different things to a bunch of different people, and then you can alter it slightly and it sounds massively different. The way the runes and some of the other puzzle elements of the game are put together, I feel, kind of allude to that idea, and they get you into that headspace of seeing the world a little bit more interconnectedly and understanding that a lot of the stuff that Senna was seeing is probably based on stuff that her eyes are actually perceiving and then being enhanced or altered or otherwise influenced by the way her mind processes information. And I think that comes up in a lot of different ways with a lot of the puzzles. So, like, there might be a bridge that you need to cross that's missing a section, but if you stand from a particular angle, there are these distortions of light hanging in the air.
It's like a frozen moment kind of cut up and pictured in front of you.
And it's like the image has been shredded and then scattered into the air. And if you stand in the right location, it lines up in such a way that the bridge can be seen, and then the bridge is there and can be crossed. And a lot of little things like that about how our perceptions,
because the game's always getting you to look at things. It's always getting you, like, I mean, one of the earliest buttons you get is a focus. Senua zooms in and she focuses on something and she looks intently. And so the game is always getting you to look for runes or to look for the images that aren't there at some angles but are. Or it gets you to look through portals and walk through them to an altered place that is slightly different.
So that's a really fascinating part of the game. There's a section where you're trying to find Valravan, who's like a trickster god of illusion.
Yeah.
And by walking through these gates with his symbol hung above them, what you can see in the world changes. So there might be a wall there, you walk through this gate, and you're in the same physical place, but that wall is no longer visible and you can walk past it.
Yeah.
And what I really love about that, and so many of the puzzles, they're physically grounded in the game world.
Yes.
So it isn't that you press the secret site button and that changes your secret site to the Nega realm.
Yeah, or you walk over to a console and you do a hacking minigame.
Yeah, nothing like that. It's just physically orienting yourself in this world, I think, really hammers home this idea that what Senua is experiencing is her reality.
Yes.
And it might not be objectively verifiable in the way that a neurotypical person might see it, but that doesn't make it fake. It is true, and it is her real experience in the exact same way my experience of this moment is also my brain's perception of the stimuli that I'm experiencing.
And I think that's further enhanced by the camera work done in the game.
Mm.
So you have this third-person camera behind Senua as she moves through the world, and it genuinely feels like a handy cam. There's something about how it moves and how it's held and how you walk that gives you this feeling that you're right there in the world.
Yeah.
And not only that, but in the cutscenes, they're all shot from, like, first-person perspective. Almost all of them usually are.
So, that's interesting. Finish your point, but I'm gonna disagree with you.
Okay. A lot of the cutscenes are kind of shot looking as if they're looking through someone's eyes, and Senua is looking at that person.
Okay, so like an implied first-person perspective. Yeah. Okay, I see what you mean.
Because she addresses the camera. She'll face it. Yeah. She'll talk to it like a person. That's how it interacts a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Not always, but...
Yeah, there are definitely moments where Senua perceives the camera as someone that she can address.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that that's true of every cutscene, but there is a lot of that in there, definitely.
It really grounds you in her reality and what she's experiencing and how real that is.
Yeah, I agree.
There's almost never the moment, like, I don't think there is very often, it might only be a few times, where you feel like you snap out and you see the true world.
Yeah, for the most part, what you're experiencing is Senua's perception of reality. Now, there are a couple of points that I feel are designed to be a little bit fourth wall breaking. And one of the big ones is something that I think you were a little bit put off by. Senua herself is a 3D model that is acted by Milena Jurgens through motion capture. Mm-hmm. The other three characters that you see that actually have spoken dialogue are Druth, Senua's mother, Dillian, her father as well. Four characters. All of them are captured in live action. And when Senua experiences a memory or, you know, has a perception of them speaking to her, it's this kind of superimposed live action shot over a 3D animated world.
I didn't pick this immediately.
Yeah, I kind of wondered at first.
And as the game goes on, you're kind of not really ever sure. There's a really good Instagrammer at Ninja Theory because they use filters like nobody's business, right? And the way they filter the live action actors into the world and kind of portray them over things is spectacular. Although admittedly, there are some moments right at the end where you just see hot boyfriend.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're a person with person
and
flesh.
It's like something out of a soap opera.
Yeah. But the full motion video inside the game is wonderfully done and usually handled really well.
And my first reaction to that was that a budget saving measure?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, probably that might have been a factor.
Yeah.
But one of the things I think that's interesting about this game is there are so few parts of it that I can point to and say, that has nothing to do with the theme. That's just a gameplay measure or a design feature.
I mean, we tried to find those things and we kept finding they were linked in.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the things I find really fascinating about this is Druth early on.
Yep.
It's hard to tell whether or not he's a 3D model. But Dillian, the only time that you actually see his face, I think you only see him twice.
Yeah.
But right at the end, it's really obvious that he's live action. And the first time, it's more obvious than any of the characters. Mm-hmm. Senua's mother is very hard to distinguish between 3D model or live action, whereas her father is a bit easier to tell still. And there are parts where Druth is really obvious and Druth is less obvious. And I can't help but think that that's deliberate.
Yeah.
And there's a concept in certain kinds of theater where you make the fact that you're watching a play obvious, right?
Yeah,
so they do like scene changes in fully lit stages and that kind of thing to help the audience remain aware of the fact that what they're looking at is a work of art. It is a depiction and they are supposed to think about it consciously rather than just being along for the ride and being fully immersed. I wonder if this is an element of that because there are a couple of times where, again, like you mentioned before, Senua looks right down the barrel of the camera right at you.
Yeah.
And these aren't traditionally fourth wall breaking points, but I do feel they are a little bit, I think the term is Brechtian, but a little bit like that, where they are designed to get you thinking about the game as a work of art and remembering, hey, I can go and read about psychosis when I'm done here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On top of that, the different levels of what we would call like live action photorealism, I feel kind of mirror Senua's attachment to those moments as they're happening. So Dillian's really obvious live action thing is right at the end where it's quite an intimate moment, but it's also the moment that immediately precedes her letting him go. And I feel like the alienation is supposed to be deliberate there when you see her father, and it's kind of off-putting when you look at him. I feel like that's supposed to be deliberately alien. But when you're talking to her mother, who's quite a nurturing experience, who Senua very much misses, it's almost impossible to tell that you're looking at a live-action video. Does that make sense, or am I talking crap here?
No, here's the thing. I get what you mean. It feeds into the narrative. I don't know if that's what they intended, but it does give you that effect. Because even Druth, who I think is the perfect example of phasing in and out, there are some moments where he looks like a 3D model, and there's other moments where he looks like a person, and they'll go in between each other as the game progresses. Like, it's very interesting how they play with that. And look, it feels very deliberate.
And look, I might be putting a lot of this on there. It might just be, hey, sometimes they didn't do as good a job at masking it. But I think something that comes up a lot is, like, there's kind of a myth in less good depictions of mental illness, that idea that if a person's crazy, they think they're the only sane person left. Like, that's kind of a cliche. And that's something that this game does not depict about Senua. She often questions her own experiences and often questions the consequences that she has on the people around her and whether or not people who are highly critical of her are actually right about her and that kind of thing. I feel like just the idea that sometimes hallucinations or delusions are more and less convincing is probably mirrored in this element as well, that sometimes we only hear Druth's voice and Senua is speaking back to him when it happens. And other times Druth is...
it's like a memory.
Yeah, it's like delivering a unilateral monologue that Senua has no input into. And it's almost like he's lecturing to her or invading her space or something like that. I think that there's probably some mirrors in there that I don't have the words to describe.
And I think ultimately this comes to what I would consider probably the biggest thing people focused on when they were discussing how this game handled psychosis, which I'm blown away we haven't talked about until this very point.
Yeah, I suddenly realized where you're going with this. Yeah. I'm like, how is this not the first thing we said?
Yeah, I was thinking about it before, but the game uses binaural audio, which basically gives you the feeling that there are people all around you talking to you.
Yeah, I mean, the exact way the technology works is not super important, but it simulates the way two ears perceive sound.
And it simulates them by having two physical ears.
Yes.
I need it. I have seen it. Search binaural microphones for a laugh. It is weird.
It is a little bit weird.
Yeah.
The reason this decision is meaningful, though, is because binaural audio is very important for positional understanding of sound. So it isn't just that you get that 7.1 perception,
which is basically direction and volume. Like, something is coming from my left and it's loud.
What this does really well is it makes the voices, because Senua hears whispers and voices throughout the game. They're sort of collectively referred to as the Furies.
Yeah.
And then there are other voices like the Darkness, who's a specific character. The narrator is a specific voice. And then you've obviously got Druth and Dillion and the others. But whenever you hear a voice, it is positional, and it gives you a real sense that these sounds are diegetic. It's not that the way you'd normally hear a narrator in another movie or a game. These voices come from a place because, again, they exist in Senua's reality.
Yeah. Therefore they exist in the world.
Yeah, it isn't just, oh, these are the voices that Senua hears that she's imagining. It is, these are tangible voices, and it makes such a huge difference, I think, to the experience of the game.
And not only do the voices come from a place, but they are talking about what is happening and Senua's fears and everything. They even comment on when they come and go. Like, they're always talking, they're always speaking to her, they're always speaking to you sometimes. Like, if you stop for a moment, they wonder if you're confused or lost.
Some of those smaller touches were really good. We are coming to a point that in one of the articles you read, you were saying that one of the criticisms of the game is the voices are sometimes helpful, and the experience of this particular person was that the voices aren't. The voices that Senua hears are sometimes helpful and sometimes quite distressing. It sort of changes throughout the game at different points. Once again, we don't want to say that this is perfect for every person, but there are definitely some people who have spoken about this game and how their experience of the voices is sometimes positive or does sometimes reflect what's going on.
That's definitely true. They do use the voices to sort of remove HUD elements, for example.
Yeah.
Like in combat, when an enemy's about to attack you from behind, the voices will tell you.
And that's really interesting. Beyond that, like you say, if you get lost, they'll kind of direct you. There's one point in particular where the voices recede for a little while, when when Senua feels quite isolated and alone, and when she removes herself from that situation and the voices return, they're almost kind of supportive and sound a little bit grateful to have found her again, and you get this sense that she's comforted by them returning, whereas in other moments she's quite upset at what they're saying and their presence. And that variation, again, I think is important, because if they were just horrible all the time, I feel like that is a more narrow, tokenistic approach to depicting it than if they are a little bit more varied.
That's the problem with combating stereotypes, isn't it? Right? Like, sometimes the stereotypes aren't as false as we think. It's just how they interact around people, and that's more, it could be more of the problem.
Yeah, like sometimes stereotypes are about limitation. I'm reminded of Tourette's. I know a couple of people who have Tourette's, and they don't have that very well-known type of Tourette's, that where the tick is expletive words, where people swear without intent and that kind of thing. I know people who have physical tics, and that's how their Tourette's manifests. And it isn't that that depiction that we're all familiar with is untrue. It's just that the actual condition is much broader than that.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting line to walk, where you don't want to try and make your depiction as completely broad to the point of meaninglessness, where nobody can really recognize it because you're trying to include everything.
Yeah.
But by the same token, you don't necessarily want it to be all of those exact things that are in every movie that we already understand, because they're the stereotypical depictions of it.
And I think going for this kind of up and down, neutral, dynamic kind of tone for the voices, where they rise and fall and they change and sometimes disagree with each other as well. You know, you will hear dissenting voices among the voices constantly.
Yeah.
It was a good choice to go with, because it better handle for people to get on.
Once again, when it comes to hallucinations, as I was saying before, they're not always born from whole cloth. They're not always in contradiction to what can be perceived. And so the voices being relevant is another criticism that I've heard, that for a lot of people, the voices they hear are entirely random and unrelated, or the noises, I should say, they hear might not even be voices. For others, though, they are based on what the brain is able to interpret from around them. And so the fact that the voices are able to say things like "look out" or "he's slow moving" to give you these kind of passive tutorial moments on how to deal with enemies, the fact that the voices can be relevant to the experience in the moment of the person is something that does happen.
And I was going to say, it does feed into the narrative as well. So it does affect the way the story is told. It might have been a decision as well made to just help facilitate the story. And it was a way of merging these two things together.
One other thing I do want to touch on, because I don't want to blow past this, you made a very good point. There's no HUD in this game. The closest thing you have to a HUD element is some of Senua's equipment will glow when particular attacks or special moves are ready. But other than that, no HUD whatsoever. And once again, it really helps ground you in this sense that this is Senua's reality, not a simulation. What I think is really interesting about this is like I said, I empathize with the way this game depicts mental illness quite a bit. And I think that's so strange for something that I wasn't expecting it from.
Yeah.
The writing in this game is fucking incredible.
Stellar, really.
Like, I've had better writing in games, but this is right up there, and it's tonally appropriate. The character voices are very well defined. And it's just, you feel it. Like, you feel what they're saying. And
I think it's that thing that you say, that the voices of the characters are well defined. I think that that really just drives the narrative in a game, especially.
I'm reminded of, have you ever read A Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime?
No, but probably should.
It's been a long time since I've read it, but one of the things that that does is it's written from the perspective of somebody who's on the autism spectrum, and it's written in a period where we had much more ingrained stereotypes of what someone with autism would be like. One of the things I thought was interesting about that book is that it demonstrates that in the way this character narrates, that some of the stereotypes we have about people on the autism spectrum are inaccurate, because they narrate with simile and with metaphor, which is not something we generally think of people on the autism spectrum as being able to do. We think of them as being mathematically intelligent, not so much linguistically intelligent. This game has some of the narration. It's quite poetic in some ways, and it speaks a kind of truth without necessarily being literal. And once again, I feel like that's almost like this demonstration of how Senua thinks to some extent. There was one point that really hit me where I live, as far as my emotional core goes. I'm going to quote it here. We might cut this out. The narrator says pretty much this: "Have you ever died before? It's a serious question. When the illusion of self is shattered, you simply cease to be, though it may not seem that way to others. You know when it's true. You can feel it. A stranger in your own body. An imposter. And nothing is the same ever again. Senua had died before, and she will do so again. You can be sure of that. And this sense of disassociation from oneself when, I mean, I'm going to use I words here because I don't want to speak for anybody else.
Go for it.
When I was struggling with my depression when it was at its height, there were a lot of moments like that where I felt like the person I was under the influence of it was not myself, that I was detached from myself, that I was, like it says, an imposter in my own body. And there was this, it's a weird thing to say, but I almost felt like depression in some ways was kind of like a demon that had possessed me.
Yeah,
and was
an other.
An other, yeah. It was something else in my own mind that was kind of altering who I was and my sense of self. And so hearing this at this point really resonated with me really, really deeply, that sense of disassociation from oneself due to mental illness, that sense of somehow being fake or wrong or not being able to trust my own senses and perceptions of things, feeling alienated from other people's perceptions of things. That was really affecting for me. And what I think is fascinating about this game is that we've alluded to this a couple of times. A big thing that Senua is dealing with is not her psychosis. As far as the actual arc of her journey goes, and these are words I'm stealing from you, so you know, I might just let you say this part.
Yeah, I was actually blown away by how this game wasn't an exploration of her psychosis. It was an exploration of her grief and her emotions around the death of her loved one.
Yes, and so we will be careful about our exploration here, because from the audience perspective, it's an exploration of both. As far as Senua's emotional journey and her arc through the story, it is about her dealing with grief more so, I think, than it is about her dealing with her psychosis.
I really do feel that. Like, when I look at the narrative arc of the story, it's all tied to her finally accepting the fact that the person she loves is gone.
Yeah.
And is no longer here, and there's nothing you can do. And accepting that fact. But it's not a journey to fix herself from her psychosis. This is just how she exists. This
yeah.
is how she processes
And things. What I really love about that is, because we were talking about this before the show, and I kind of had a vague sense of that, but you made that so much clearer in my mind when you brought that point up. And that's part of why I included that quote, because I feel like it's talking about both things at once. It's talking about this sense of disassociation from herself due to her psychosis, but also because of the depression she's feeling at the loss of her partner. And the part of my life where I was in the deepest element of depression was a grieving process.
Yeah.
That was what triggered that and exacerbated that in me. And a similar kind of grieving event has exacerbated Senua's mental health, and I say mental health in the general sense, both from an emotional health sense as well as a neurological health sense.
And if you treat her own personal history that she presents to you as fact, you can kind of see in her own personal life where she's arced, like where her psychosis has become more prevalent and receded and things like that. When she's moved out of an abusive environment with her father and she's moved into a more kind and accepting.
Yeah.
That's the word I'm looking for. It's accepting of her experience. She seems to find, it feels like her psychosis is tied into what is affecting her in her life and her experience there. And it's more grounded in her emotional state rather than in some sort of disease that I feel like mental illness gets presented. Like you look at some movies especially, and it's like, I think Silver Lining Playbook is my favorite. It's like these two people are mentally ill, but then they find each other and love, and so don't take medicine.
Yeah. So, and I think that that's so important in this, because the reason Senua finds so much comfort with Dillian is in that acceptance, but he's not the masculine equivalent of a manic pixie dream girl. He doesn't come in and cure her so she doesn't need meds anymore. It's so much more respectful than that.
Yeah.
And it's definitely, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a subversion of that trope, but it certainly does not adhere to that trope at all. One of the things that I think is very interesting about what you said there is this idea of the societal stigma of psychosis being a major source of the difficulty of living with psychosis. And this game makes a lot of allusions to that. Senua's father is quite dogmatic, and he believes that Senua is cursed, just like her mother was cursed.
Yeah.
And he tries to punish the curse out of her. He has these, they call them cruel rituals and things a couple of times. And they make it very clear that Senua was abused as a child because of this. When she meets Dillian, he is much more accepting of her, and he thinks in a much less binary way.
Yeah.
There's a quote in there about something about how he appreciated seeing the cracks in the world and the color that was behind them and that kind of thing. And so he really appreciates the way Senua sees the world.
That's the difference they're trying to derive, right?
Yeah.
They're trying to illustrate why these things can come out of people and why they can be exacerbated.
Yeah, and so exacerbation is a good word for it, but we don't even have explicit confirmation that Senua's symptoms of psychosis were any different from when she lived with her father or when she lived with Dillian. They might have been experienced to a similar kind of level. It's just that one environment was so much more nurturing and safe for her than the other. There's a couple of other narrative elements where they hit on this. There's a village of people that Dillian and Senua, and this is all backstory stuff, but Senua and Dillian go and live with this community of people, and a sickness infects the town.
I think it was a plague. Yeah,
some kind of plague. And she's blamed for that because she's considered to be strange or outside the norm, and the community stigmatizes her because of it. Again, Dillian doesn't. He shows her support and acceptance and that kind of thing. And so this idea that one of the major difficulties of living with psychosis and other mental health issues isn't even necessarily the symptoms of that specific condition.
What you said just also reminds me of the fact that Dillian is also described as a friend first and lover second. It's a good touch because I feel like the game kind of bumps up against that problem of, oh, there's the romantic man. I get a little worried. It's like, oh, there's the love interest who fixes everything.
Mm.
And I think they do a really good job of showing that a bit more in depth.
Yeah. And this is something that, again, we should have mentioned a bit earlier. One of the big things that is not in line with that trope is that the end of Senua's arc comes from her letting go of Dillian and accepting that his loss and accepting that he was a very positive influence in her life,
yes,
but she doesn't need him back to be worth something.
Yes.
And so there's thumbs up stuff there from the feminist angle, certainly, but also from this thing with this trope that we're discussing, that Dillian is not like the cure for her illness, because the whole point of her story is accepting that he's gone.
Yeah, but the kind of lessons and the things that he's told her live on with her, because I think the game culminates with this ending that brings this idea of, it's a little heavy-handed when I revisited it, but the idea of accepting death and embracing life and acting like a child and all the joy kind of stuff, the stuff you want to, as someone who's recently experienced a loved one passing, it's kind of stuff you do want to hear, no matter how corny it is, right? It's just nice to hear things like people telling you that, you know, they were special and there were special things about them, and you'll remember the lessons you learned. You remember all the good times, and they will always be with you. The darkness that plagues her, that actually physically infests her as she explores hell. At the end, the Furies tell you how it's not gone. It's changed. It's different. It's still a part of her, just like they are still a part of her.
Mm.
This is who she is.
Yeah, and you realize that this darkness, which I assume that it was sort of a metaphor for her psychosis, but as you get further into the game, you realize that the darkness that's infecting her is not the psychosis. It's, in fact, her grief and trauma at the loss of her partner and her inability to move past it.
Yeah, it was a brutal death.
Like, yeah, it was bad.
He was sacrificed to gods.
Vikings were not great in some respects.
Yes, there's like all that trauma. So it was very interesting to see in a video game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and it was the way that I felt they sold that ending. It ended the story. It capped the arc. It flowed narratively. It demonstrated through metaphor and visuals reaching this point where she accepts that he's gone and moves on as herself.
Yeah. I think that ending, I mean, because there are some people who have misinterpreted that as her overcoming her psychosis and curing her illness. And once again, I'm going to say it. Gamers are fucking dumb. Like, I get that not every single person has a fucking literary analysis degree or whatever, but when the voices are not only still present in her mind, but literally explicitly saying, the darkness is not gone, it's here, but it's changed, and then Senua leaves by saying, like...
She looks right at the camera, you, and says, we still have many stories.
It feels like the developers were making such a huge effort to communicate to an audience that she wasn't magically cured and that was her happy ending. She got away from the bad thing. What I think is also interesting about that depiction and why that ending I think is important is because one of the things that the game is trying to communicate about mental illness of this kind is it isn't just this huge burden and weakness that people are cursed with and have to live in constant suffering for. In the featurette that they have about the making of the game, they include a couple of quotes from some of the people who experience these kinds of psychosis and mental illness. And some of them were talking about how some of the hallucinations they experienced were quite beautiful and that kind of thing. There was a lot of talk about the nature of creativity. And again, this is a stereotype which I want to try and not engage with too deeply, but there's that sort of myth about the tortured artist that, like, oh, you know, people who have mental health issues are going to be great writers and that kind of thing. And people said that to me when I was in the depths of depression. And
gross.
That, yeah, it's not good to hear. And at least for the very, you know, my experience of my mental health issues, everything I wrote then was terrible. And it's because I wasn't capable of organizing my thoughts in a way that allowed me to write in the way that works for me. That said, there have been some brilliant thinkers who have been affected by different kinds of mental illness. And so while it's a kind of a dismissive thing to hear someone say to you directly, there is truth in the idea that deviation from neurotypicality results in different kinds of thinking. And
I mean, that's why we want to promote diversity and things like that.
Yeah,
diversity,
exactly.
Not just of... It's diversity of experience and all that kind of stuff.
And this game does a lot to imply that some of the way Senua perceives the world and thinks is actually quite beneficial to her.
It does a lot to show that it's beneficial to her. They're literally physically having her warned of danger.
Yeah.
But it does also depict her being able to help others.
Yeah, like she learns how to wield a sword by watching Dillian from afar, and Dillian notices her at one point and says, "Where did you learn to fight like that?" And she's like, "Oh, by watching you." And he's really pleased by that. He's almost blown away by how impressive that is. And I think that's a very powerful moment. And the way that Senua sees patterns where other people don't see them.
Which is reinforced in, like, the runes and...
Yeah, and the story we're telling before about the village that gets infected by the plague.
Yeah.
The reason she and Dillian don't get sick is because Senua realizes that the water is off. There's something wrong with it. It tastes foul, but everybody else in the village just ignores her. Yeah. And then they drink the water and get sick, but she and Dillian don't because she knew there was something there that other people weren't able to perceive. And it was because of the way she makes those links and recognizes those patterns.
And that's good to have, because I do feel like a lot of the times when people hear voices, they are always bad, and that is it. And there is no beauty there. It is just pain, always pain.
Mm.
And probably don't want to always have that experience. I don't think there's not a place for them, but especially because the game itself is so dark and the story of grief is so dark, being able to use that to sort of counterbalance it is good.
Yeah. And of course, we don't want to dismiss the kinds of people for whom mental illness is a almost exclusive, constant struggle.
Yeah.
There are parts of this game that are inspired by the stories of people for whom their hallucinations are almost exclusively distressing and inspire fear. And I mean, there are people who have that experience who might see a game like this that shows elements of psychosis as being positive and feel like they're being tokenized or feel like they're being turned into, like, inspiration porn or something like that.
And I can't 100% tell if it's doing that magical kind of thing. Like, you know, is it psychosis or is it spirit stuff? Because it's kind of titled into... You know, I can't 100% say that the presentation is perfect, but it feels like there's a lot of good intentions, and I don't know.
Yeah, on that note, I mean, you spend a lot of the game kind of wondering to what extent is this a hallucination and to what extent is Senua actually going to Helheim to confront Hela. The final confrontation with Hela, I think, reinforces the idea that the majority of it was a hallucination because it's so visually distinct, and it kind of breaks the whole consistency that they've had up to that point. I mean, one could easily argue that just that part of it was a hallucination then, or maybe that's just what Helheim looks like.
I mean, you say that, and I also remember the part where the goddess Hel is still on the floor smoldering in that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, the game, it's like the end of Inception, you know?
Yeah.
It leaves you questioning your experience, because you questioning your experience is more interesting than it going, it's this.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that clear cut, in my opinion. And I think by leaning into a bit of uncertainty there, it colors in the rest of it. Like, this whole experience has been real, regardless of what actually is real
or not. Yeah, that's totally, I completely agree with that.
And I also do understand the idea of, knowing the truth. But this is Senua's truth that we experience, and I think that's kind of the more important one.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you made a point before we started about it's kind of like asking if Coda is a real person in the Beginner's Guide. Yeah. It's really irrelevant to the point of what you're experiencing.
Yeah, true or not, it won't change the important lessons that the game, in especially Beginner's Guide, is trying to tell you. I just think there's the stories about Senua's grief and her processing that and her going through that, and this game is how she does it.
Yeah, and I think that another important thing, if we can sort of, while we wrap this conversation up, return to that idea of the meta framing of the game.
Yeah.
Some of the criticisms I've read about this from neurotypical people almost make it seem like this game was trying to be an instruction manual on what psychosis is like, and it's not really what it's about.
I don't think everyone can pull Odin's sword out of the tree after going through four magical experiences.
What I do think that this is more about, and what it does, I think, quite successfully, is build empathy with that experience, and that's what it's trying to do in the neurotypical players who play the game. It is trying to give us an insight into what that life is like a little bit, not in a literal way, not in a, these are the kinds of symptoms that all people with psychosis have, in an experiential way, in a way that helps us understand the confusion and the fear and the inconsistencies that are sometimes associated with hallucinations and delusions of these kinds.
And it does it by basically telling a Nordic fable. Like, yeah, the game,
it is a dark fantasy game.
Yeah, the game references lots of stories about Odin and Thor and all those kind of Norse mythologies.
Loki and Fenrir and Hela.
All those times. It talks about that. The game itself is like an amalgamation of kind of adventures and experience. It is a fable, if I understand what fables are. Like, it has this kind of story, this arc, and it's a legend. And it does this in a way that also has like a character that's wonderfully diverse.
Yeah.
Right? It has an interesting perspective that I think adds to the experience. So not only does it give you a look into how someone would experience this kind of stuff in a like a in a fantastical setting, but it does it with empathy. Like I don't know.
Yeah.
After reading the articles and after playing the game, I just feel like there was care here. And I was just really impressed by that.
Yeah, I think that is evident even without necessarily reading the articles. Like, you can feel while you play the game that it's trying. You know, it's trying to be more than just a cool vision trip. You know, it's trying to be something that's more weighty than that. And if nothing else, it's trying to get you to relate to the character.
It just makes you think about like 20 people. That's such a small team, right? Yeah. Games these days get made with some of them with thousands of people, just such large numbers, and they feel like they've made by a giant committee.
Yeah, I think even a mid-sized studio like Telltale has hundreds of employees.
That's so many people. And the idea that this small group of 20 people didn't put any thought into what they were making. We put almost more thought into this podcast before we started recording it. There's just two of us.
Yeah. Right?
I couldn't imagine like that kind of something about that small group and those people and then having played it. I don't know. It just feels like there was thought and tension.
Yeah. And when you have a team that's that small, it's really hard to imagine that you could make a game like this and not have everybody be on the same page about it. And especially when they talk about the consultations they did with other people and how much effort they put into that. I really feel like it's kind of irrelevant to say, oh, they meant well.
Yeah.
When someone's done harm, I totally accept
that's
that.
That's true. Yeah, definitely.
But I don't think this is cynical. I really don't. And I think that it is one of the more interesting games that we've discussed on this show. On top of that, I mean, like, we've got to say this. There are parts of this game that, just from a visual design and perspective and stuff like that, are fucking terrifying and fucking emotive. And even independent of whether or not the depiction of psychosis is accurate, are incredibly well designed. Like, the level of effort and skill and, I hate using buzz terms like passion. I feel like you can feel it when you play this.
And I was just floored by the pacing as well. You know, it takes a lot of time. Like, it lets you move through environments and scenes at pace. There's a surprising amount of puzzles in this game.
For an action game, you probably only spend about 20% of the time actually fighting.
Yeah, if that, because it's so fast and brutal. Because they understand the tempo of the game and they play with it. They put those combats in the right moments.
Like, we've spent over an hour talking about this game in a really intense, like, intellectual way. But every now and then you just kind of have to sit back and have this moment of lucidity. It's just like, fuck me, how did this get made? Like, you just kind of step back from it and step back from all of the questions about, you know, what are the moral implications of making a game that inaccurately depicts this kind of, you know, and wondering about whether or not, theoretically, this kind of game should be made with the neurotypical perspective in mind versus that. You know,
really intellectualize this game.
Yeah, like, really high-minded questions. When you sit back and just think about the emotion you felt while playing it, like, there was no fucking point I was not 100% invested in it from start to finish. Yeah. Like, it was harrowing and physically exhausting, and I really feel like they depicted Senua in such a way, like, the way we spoke about it is, it does it injustice, because we talk about, like, even when we're talking about Dillian and explicitly stating the fact that he doesn't save her or whatever, like, the implication isn't even there in the game. Like, just us saying, oh, he doesn't come in and save her, makes it sound like it's more like that than even us explicitly. Like, it's so good. It's just so fucking good.
And I have heard a lot of people talk about clipping and environmental factors and, like, kind of the lower end of, like, the idea that the game's a bit sort of dodgy and buggy. That's been a common thread. And I did encounter what I would call inelegant camera work, whereas the camera will phase through objects occasionally and things like that. That's probably the worst of it for me. I never found myself clipping on anything or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was patched out now.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Might be a reason to play games a bit later than everyone else.
Yeah, there was that famous bug. You go through the waterfall and it puts your torch out and then autosave straight after doing it. And so then you can't relight your torch and you get killed. I found that part in the game. And I will say it's the only part of the whole game where I feel like the level design was a little bit off, because you're supposed to go down a different tunnel that you can't really see unless you do this huge loop and look around. And so other than that, there's nothing that I can say. Like, I didn't have any camera issues, any animation issues, any clipping issues, nothing.
It's nice to play something like that I feel like is digestible. You know, I get tired of, like, these long, drawn-out kind of experiences. And when you just have something that's so wonderfully put together and paced beautifully well, and it's just fully engaging, so satisfying to play.
I want to finish up by talking about one of my favorite moments in the game.
Yeah.
And again, it's a moment I felt a great deal of empathy with. Senua is approaching Hela's domain.
Yeah.
She's on the home stretch. She's about to come face-to-face with Hela. And she's trying to think of how she's going to convince Hela to release Dillian's soul back to the living world. And her basic bargaining chip is herself. It's the only thing she kind of has of value, her own soul. And she's an incredibly capable warrior, and she knows it. And everybody knows it about her. That's the one of the only things people don't disagree with about Senua, is that she's an incredible fighter.
Yeah.
And so she's postulating this idea of trading her soul for Dillian's, because then at the very least he'll go back to the realm of the living. But even as she's saying, I'm a brilliant warrior, I can fight alongside Hela at Ragnarok, which is the most metal fucking thing in the world, there's still this insistence in her that a soul is actually worthless, and she's going to go to Hela and present her soul with all of its her fighting ability. And, like, they've built up this idea that Ragnarok is the only thing the gods fear, and having people to fight alongside them
is all
they care about. It's like, that's their only long-term goal, is delaying or surviving Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Even with all of the explicit knowledge that she would be an asset to Hela, and that she's fought through every monster Hela's thrown at her and still made it to there, she's an incredibly capable fighter, that insistence that she's worthless because of the way the world perceives her, again, that really hit home. And I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I think really what I'm trying to say is this, is despite all of that intellectualizing that we've talked about, there's not a moment I didn't feel for that character and I didn't feel for that experience. It is a really impressive game and a really, really satisfying one to end the season on.
Yeah. 9.5 out of 10. Oh, sorry, I just saw a moment to just trash the moment.
Yeah,
I just,
no, it's,
I went
it's,
right
it's,
for it.
It's cool. I was only talking about my deepest anxieties.
So,
I suppose that does it for another season of the Slowpokes. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Once again, it's an absolute pleasure to be able to do this, and your support means the world to us.
We absolutely adore you, each and every one.
Just as much as we adore Senua. A little bit less, honestly. I'm being real. Senua's pretty rad.
Got the biggest eyes in the world, though.
Yeah, and it's like, it's Frodo syndrome, right? Like, everybody thinks they've been enhanced, but no, they're just that big.
Yeah, God.
So, what are we doing between seasons, John? Do we have any idea whatsoever?
Right now, we do not, but when we do, we will put it in right here.
We're doing nothing. Hey folks, David from the future here. We have decided to take a short break while we figure out what we're going to do in season 4. But don't panic, we are coming back. The scheduled date for return will be on the 17th of July, so keep your ears peeled, gross, for that. We'll be coming back with a main episode, and the game we'll be talking about is Her Story, which I'm excited for because it looks like an interesting character piece with a lot of intimate moments and interesting ways of depicting a story in games. And John is interested in because he has a hard-on for FMV games. So look forward to that. 17th of July is when we're coming back. Once again, everybody, thanks so much for supporting us up to season 3, and I'm going to throw back to our past selves to finish the episode. I'm really excited for it. Are you, John? I mean, it's such a...
Can't wait.
Look, sometimes people have good ideas, yeah, and you're like, that's a good idea. Yeah. Sometimes you have an idea and you're like, I'm a fucking genius. Oh. Like, and you can't help but be impressed with yourself.
You know what?
The idea that we just said and told our audience about is one of those.
I don't think we'll ever have an idea better. You should give up after that.
So, yeah, I mean... Maybe we'll do nothing. I don't know. But we ourselves are going to take a little bit of a break. We will be back with season 4.
Yes, yeah, such slackers.
If you like what we do and you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter at SlowpokesCast.
Yep.
We're on Facebook, facebook.com/SlowpokesPodcast. And our website, slowpokespodcast.com, has links to everything else we do.
We will update you as to what... We're having a little bit of a think.
Yeah, we're still working out the roster for season 4.
Because of how season 3's gone and some of our feelings on it and having played Senua and everything, I think we're both like, oh no, we want to get some really good games on that list. So
yeah, so as John said, we will keep you posted. In the meantime, I've been David.
I've been John.
Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great season 3.